In jumping into this, I want to admit a couple notes of awkwardness. First being that I am not an expert on money. I am not an expert on economics, finances, anything that's surrounding that. I took one economics class in engineering many, many years ago, and all I remember is compound interest. So, and I acknowledge that many of you have better backgrounds than I do. You work with money, you deal with it all the time, and you can teach me, you can teach the rest of us what how this world actually runs. And I want to, I want to make it clear that the world, or acknowledge that the world is very complex. It's not so simple as we like to think it is, and there are many issues surrounding money in this world. The other note of awkwardness I want to say is that I acknowledge that there is a power dynamic going on here of me preaching about money, especially since I'm being supported by you, the listeners. So I'm very aware of that. So I just want to make it clear right from the start that this is not a sermon on what to do with money. Okay? This is not a sermon on how to make money or even how to spend it. So just lay it all there. Okay. However, this is a sermon on the meaning of money and perhaps what or how do we begin to have a theology of money? Right? So this is very rudimentary, very basic. That's why I call it foundations. and it's not going to cover everything. We still have many months on money to come. So, but we just want to lay out some foundations. And, just thought this was a cute picture of a girl counting her pennies or coins. When we think about money, we have a lot of questions. And last week when Ted solicited questions about money, these are some of the ones that we kind of categorize as kind of surrounding foundational issues about money. So these are questions coming from you, and maybe you have more questions that you'll have after this. So, yeah, so things like, what does the Bible say about money? What is good stewardship? So a lot of kind of, there were kind of broader questions about money and also very practical questions about money. So this morning, when we look at foundations, I'm going to touch upon three kind of major areas. We're going to look at what is money, what the Bible says about money, and start asking the question of how should I think about money as a Christian? How can we begin to handle money as a Christ follower? And as I was preparing, I realized that, and for you too, it might be good to stop at this point and think about our assumptions about money. So a lot of us come into this with certain ideas about money that may or may not be true. So we all live with certain assumptions about money. And some examples for me, when I thought, okay, what are my kind of starting assumptions about money? For example, I assume that an accumulation of money will bring security and also freedom to do the things that I want to do. That's an assumption that I have. Another assumption that I have is that there will be a time in my life, provided I live long enough, that I won't be able to generate money. And so I need to prepare for that time. For whatever reason, I may not be able to make money. Another assumption, I need money to live. Right, I need money to actually survive in this world. basic stuff. Another assumption I have is money will not make me happy. So, with your pieces of paper right now, or your notebooks or whatever, I want you to think about what assumptions you may have about money and just start jotting them down. And I'll give you just maybe like 30 seconds to just jot those down. Won't be shared, like you're not going to pass that piece of paper to me or anything, so try to be as honest as you can about your assumptions of money. All right, does anyone need more time? You can revisit those later, because you can take this home and think about your assumptions of money. Okay. Cool. I'm going to present additional assumptions when we start looking at the theology of money. So these are my assumptions as we continue to talk about money. So the first assumption that I'm going to have is that this world is going to carry on for a little while. So Jesus is not going to come back tomorrow, right? And life as we know it will end. I'm not assuming that when I'm thinking about money or theology of money. So if the world is going to carry on for some time, the second assumption that I have is that money will be a part of the world, of this world. It's part of this world now. It will continue on for that way for some time. So my third assumption then, following that, if the world's going to continue on and money's going to be part of this world, then Christians must learn how to live with money. That's my third assumption. My fourth assumption is that because Christians and people have to deal with money in this part of this world, that our God is concerned with how we deal with money. So those are my four basic assumptions for the theology of money. So, with that in mind, I want to ask the question, what is money? So the first image that I would normally get when I hear the word money is basically coins and notes, cash, right? Things that we use to purchase things. The more correct terminology for money is really a medium of exchange. Something that is given in exchange for something else. That's the basic premise of money. Now, there was a time in history where money wasn't used, way long ago. Money didn't exist. People exchanged goods or services directly. And those involved livestock, perhaps art, jewelry. So maybe it was 5 chickens for a lamb, 10 cows for a bribe, I'm not sure. So they exchange things directly. Now, this started to get more complicated. It doesn't always work quite efficiently. Maybe you didn't need an entire cow. Or perhaps you need to get grain first before making more bread to get some animal pelts, right? So the exchanges weren't always exact and was starting to get difficult. So people start to develop a kind of a promise, right? A token. And that was what first generated the concept of money. So it helps to bargain, or helps to eliminate really awkward bartering, right? So if you don't have, you might not need 10 chickens, but you want to sell your cow, so you'll get a token for what your cow is worth that you can exchange for something else. This also helps, those tokens helps eliminate, awkward bartering, and also helps to do transactions over distance and time, right? You don't have to bring all your goods with you everywhere you go. So about 5,000 years ago in ancient Mesopotamia, clay tablets were used to record these transactions, and they still have evidence of this. And they were actually very valuable because it shows who owes what or what is promised at harvest time. So-and-so is promised 500 bushels of grain. I'm not sure. But they'll keep track of those transactions on these clay tablets. And the banknote, paper money, as we understand it, was actually first created in 7th century China. So as descendants of people of Asian descent, there's a lot of a history of money in our culture. So what makes money, or how people chose what they use for money, it has to be something. You can't just use anything for money, right? So the material has to be available, affordable, durable, and I learned this word, fungible. Does anyone know what that means? No? Fungible meaning is interchangeable. So I don't have to use the exact piece of, like, instead I can give you a $10 note, it'll be the same amount as two $5 notes, right? It's exchangeable. That's what fungible means. It has to be portable and reliable. Everybody has to be able to trust this token or this promise that you're giving. Now, the Spanish conquest of what we now call South America introduced into Europe and the rest of the world gold and silver. Right, they had heaps amounts of gold. And so that is actually the start of our association of money with precious metals. Today, we don't have gold coins or silver coins, but we still use coins and notes or cash that we think of. And if you read on our bills, it's a legal tender. So, right, it's a promise given by the bank that this piece of paper is worth X amount. And not only that, today we also encounter virtual money, right? We don't actually have a cash exchange. It's an electronic exchange. So you see the evolution of money coming to this point where it's now unseen. It's just a number. But what's different today versus way back in the past is that we have what's also called credit and the whole issuing of borrowing. So that's a new phenomenon or more later development of money. So that is money. It's a medium of exchange, something that is given in exchange for something else. And money now, for the most part, is materialist. We don't see it. So, which tells us something about money. It tells us that money in itself is inherently worthless. Think about it. We cannot eat or drink a $5 bill. The nature of money is actually belief and trust. We believe that whoever is issuing the money will honor what it signifies. Going back to our $5 bill, we believe that this piece of paper will be honored by the bank to represent a value, $5. Money is only worth what someone is willing to give you for it, right? What can I get for a dollar these days? I guess if you go to, or $2, you know, we could all go to Daiso and find various things. But that's really the nature of money. It's only worth what someone is willing to give you for it. And now money is only valuable because we want it. If people don't want money, it's no longer valuable. So money is valuable because we want it. But why do we want it? We want it because it can get us a desired product or service. So it's not so much that we can accumulate heaps of $5 bills. It's the fact that that $5 bill can be used to purchase something that we need or want. That's what makes money valuable. And also that we trust that other people will accept that $5 bill in exchange for the goods and values. So I want to make it clear that money is a human assigned value. Any good service, we assign a value to it, and money represents that value. And these are, then I have a couple of other observations. And one is that money is actually an appreciation of a creative impulse. And what I mean by that is that when we make or do something that other people appreciate, money is a form of assigning a value. So you think of a piece of art. If I paint a painting and somebody really likes it, I could actually sell that painting for a certain value because somebody values that painting. It believes that it's worth X amount of money. So money is a way of where we can actually appreciate goods or services. I also think that money is an expression of how we need one another. Because in today's world, we can't all do the same things, right? And we can't all survive just by what we do alone. So, quite obviously, if I was alone in the wilderness, I would die very quickly. I cannot grow my own food. I cannot generate my own electricity. I cannot make my own clothing. And so money reminds me that I need other people in order for me to survive. And so it's a way of expressing and recognizing that other people make things or provide things that I don't have. So again, money is a medium, it's a way of interaction with each other. So looking over the history of money, the evolution of money, and where we are now, it becomes quite clear that humans created money. Right? So how does God feel about money? That's why we're here, right? To think about, well, what does the Bible say about money? I want to give you a bit of context before, just jumping into various verses. And to say that the Bible was written at a time and in an area of the world that was not wealthy. So our version of middle class didn't exist. And also interesting to note is that there wasn't any references to massive starvation unless during times of famine. Okay? So the Bible was in a context where most people weren't very, very wealthy, and there was no middle class. The majority subsisted at a minimal level, meaning people had just enough to live day by day. Either they were just above subsistence levels or just below. So they estimate during like Greco-Roman period that 60% of the population was at subsistence level. People lived by just enough. 28% of the population lived below that. So that's quite a huge number when you have nearly 30% of your population who didn't have enough. So overall, you got 90% of the population who are living at subsistence level or below. And so if you think about it, when the large majority of the population, the majority of the people all around you had only just enough money to live at a minimal level, you don't really spend a lot of time thinking about money itself. Would you agree? I know it's hard for us to think about it because we live way above subsistence level. But if everybody was living at just amount, you don't really obsess over money. Because there wasn't an expectation that everyone would be living above minimal levels. You just wouldn't expect that. You knew that there were the high elites and people who had exorbitant amount of money, but you wouldn't expect to get there, right? There was no dream of economic progress. You didn't think that, oh, someday you're going to advance higher. That wasn't part of living in those times. So the biblical writers then weren't talking about how to advance economically, because that wasn't a concern. What they wrote about in money is that that were the problems of that time was dealing with interest, fairness, and matters of bartering. And we'll look at those a little bit later. So contrasting that time with now, our poverty is different. It is on a different level because, I'm just going to limit it to, I say, Canada, Vancouver. We don't really see huge population of people living at or below subsistence level. So our level of poverty here is quite different from what the biblical writers were, the context of the biblical writers. And we also have to acknowledge or realize that it is psychologically more painful to be poor in an affluent country than it is to be poor in a poor country. Which makes sense. If everyone around you is at the same level as you, it's not so bad. But if you were poor in a very affluent country, say in Canada, it is psychologically painful. And today, we have to admit, our world is full of money. And as I mentioned before, what's new to our day is the system of credit. It was unknown to biblical writers. And that system of credit really helps is what helps drives productivity in this world. And I'm not going to get into it because I don't understand it all. I started reading about it. But it was, yeah, I realized that because we have credit systems of borrowing, this is what drives our economy to where it is. It has increased productivity and has made us very affluent and wealthy. And today, as I said, there's inherent worthlessness of money. You can't eat or live on it, and it fluctuates. The value of money changes quite significantly over time. Also different today versus before is that there's a huge concentration of economic power in giant industrial firms. Totally unknown to biblical writers. So I'm going to skim through the Old Testament and kind of look at biblical themes rather than jumping right to certain passages. So I'll give you the verses. Actually, maybe I'll just get a few people to read out. Can I have somebody look up Leviticus 25, 35 to 37? And another person looking up Deuteronomy 25, 13 to 15. So whoever has Leviticus ready? Okay. Anyone for Leviticus 25? No. Who has their Bible?
What's the verse again?
25, 35 to 37. It's Deuteronomy 25, 13 to 15. Yeah. Leviticus? Okay, sure. Ed. Can you read out loud?
Sure. Leviticus 25, 37.
So that's a clear instruction from God to his people. Basically, you don't charge interest to your family. And what is interest? Interest is a way of making money from money. Right? You borrow, you lend money to somebody, and you charge an extra amount for lending that money. That's the extra amount of interest. So God says, don't charge interest on your family, your clan, right? And it's also a call to give, right? You help out a poorer brother or sister. Now, this instruction was given because God wanted to control greed. Like, why would you charge interest on a family member or someone, you know, a fellow kinsman? Well, really, because you want to make money off of them, right? Off of the situation. So God was trying to put controls on greed and trying, preventing people from making more money. So Deuteronomy 25. So that was an instruction to make sure your dealings are fair, right? Do not have two different weights, because, of course, back then, to measure something, you need to have scales. So often it was a common practice, I guess, to have dishonest scales. So if people bring in 5 pounds of grain, a person with, just on a scales, we'd say, oh, that's actually just 3 pounds. I'm going to give you the amount for 3. So that's how they get cheated. So God was really concerned about fairness and honesty. And really, God was concerned with about basically how people can trust one another. If you have dishonest scales, you cannot trust people, and then the whole thing falls apart. So I also want to go back and say that in the Pentateuch, which is the first 5 books of the Old Testament, there is a theme that wealth is good. Wealth is given by the Lord. And God desires to bless people materially, with material possessions. But he blesses people with material possessions so that they may bless the people of the world. Right? It wasn't so that they accumulate their wealth for themselves, but in order to bless other people. And the law was given to restrict use and accumulation of property. Why? Why would God restrict it? Well, as I said, to control greed, to control human temptation, to abuse the property, but also to remind people that it's actually God who owns everything. Right? But God still wants you to enjoy what he gives you. Now, as you go on through the Old Testament, there is a rise of monarchy. Israel wants a king. And then we have the voices of the prophets. Now, with the rise of monarchy becomes concentration of wealth into a particular family or group of people. And so we have the prophets, God raising up prophets to call out against economic injustice. An example of this is in 1 Kings 21, where Samuel, when the prophet Elijah accuses the king of having killed Naboth and taken his vineyard. And later on, throughout various prophetic books, prophets are constantly accusing the rich of oppressing the poor. So we see there God's concern for injustice, economic injustice, and the misuse of wealth. Some last comments, when we come to the New Testament, many of those themes are carried forward into the New Testament, except for one thing. Material wealth in the New Testament is never promised as a guaranteed reward for obedience or hard work. I want to state that again. Material wealth is never promised to be a reward for obedience or hard work. That's very different from the Old Testament. What we see instead is Jesus and his disciples voluntarily limiting their wealth, limiting their incomes for the sake of ministry. He tells his disciples, don't take anything with you, just go, follow me. What we also see in the New Testament, which carries on from the Old Testament, is that you give from your surplus. You take what is needed, you give away what is extra. And also, you need to be honest with what is surplus. And so you have the story of Ananias and Sapphira who promised to give tithing, and they were dishonest with what they were given, and God punishes them. So these are the ideas in the New Testament. So kind of recap kind of major biblical themes. Wealth is a blessing, but there is restrictions. And God gives those restrictions on wealth and how people use that wealth. And because we have the law, God recognizes that there are problems associated with having money. In the New Testament, people should exercise enough control that once your basic needs are met, you give away. And because your basic needs are met, you should desire for more. Of course, there's a lot more that we can say. And over the next few weeks, we're going to keep on expanding on those themes. But that kind of gives you an overview of what the Bible says about money. The last thing I want to add is that in wisdom literature, so when we look at Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Job, it acknowledges that prosperity or wealth is not always the result of righteousness. Prosperity and wealth can come from wicked or ill-gotten methods, which is exploitation of others. So God does see that, and he's not happy with it. So, with all that, how do I think about money as a Christ follower today in our context? Basically, what does God have to say to us about the way we think of or view money? Assuming that he cares about the way we use money. I want to make another assumption on top of all the other ones that I've made already. That God longs for us to be in right relationship with him. And he also longs for us to be in right relationship with each other and right relatedness with creation. I want to say that again because that's very key to our whole understanding of money. God longs for us to be in right relationship with him, in right relationship with one another, and in right relatedness with creation. So my question then is, does our use of money reflect right relationships? If this is what God wants, then how does our money reflect right relationship with him, right relationships with one another, and right relatedness with creation? And are we in right relatedness with money? How do we relate to money? And so with that question, then, we have to ask ourselves, well, what is right relationship? And the other word that we use for that is righteousness. Right? Well, given the themes of the Old Testament and New Testament, I would say right relationship with God and with each other is really concerns about fairness and justice. It's also generous. And it's never exploitative. What is right relatedness concerning money? Well, as we read in our passage from Matthew, right relatedness is serving God and not money. In other words, you are not a slave to money. Instead, money is a creative tool to bless. And the question is, for all of us, is that can you give money away? Or are you enslaved to it? And also, what is right relatedness? really comes down to yourself. What you have does not signify your worth. And I think many of us need to remind ourselves of that every day. What you have does not signify your worth in the eyes of God, I should say. And we can see that because of the gospel. People are of infinite worth in the eyes of God. And because people are of infinite worth, only the life of Christ was enough to save us. No amount of sacrifice, no amount of giving offerings can be exchanged for the life of Christ that was given for us. So, when it comes to practical things, and this is where it's difficult, we have to ask questions of, what do I value? And ultimately, what is enough? And because we live in a place of great affluence, that is the major question for us. What is enough? So I'm going to give you some more questions to think about that you can write down on your piece of paper. And it's really to help you to start thinking about your own relationship with money. I found this old Calvin and Hobbes strip. I don't know if you need me to read it out loud, but his dad, Calvin's dad says, "Your mother and I have decided to give you an allowance. And it is important that one learns the value of money." And Calvin, "Money, I'm rich, I can buy off anyone, the world is mine." And his dad says, "I blew it again, dear." I thought it was a good reminder of like what a lot of what we learn about money comes from our families. So, I want you on your piece of paper, write down, think about who earned money in your family growing up. Second question, how was money used by your parents? And the third question, what did your parents teach you about money? Whether directly or indirectly, I should add. So take a few minutes, think about these questions, write them down. How and when did you first receive money? The other question is, what did you do with it? How do you feel towards money today? People, but I think it's worth thinking about. What would you do with more money? Lastly, do you ever make any serious attempts to linking your Christian faith with how you handle your money? Why or why not? Out these questions later, but I think it helps when you write them down and think about it. You're already processing what the answer would be. So don't worry if you don't get the questions exactly the way it is. I can send them out later. So the point is that you start thinking about this. So going back to the first set of questions. Could you make forums groups of no more than 3 people and share?